The politics of the healthcare debate seem to have ground to a halt in Washington, at least for now. But today's guest reminds us that the healthcare needs of the public still face substantial challenges. He's David Jones, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Selva Regina University in Newport, Rhode Island. I'm joined as always by my friend and colleague G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. On Story in the Public Square, we talk to storytellers and scholars about the narratives that shape American public life. This week, to help us make sense of the stories around the healthcare debate, we're joined by David K. Jones, assistant professor in the Department of Health Law, Policy, and Management at Boston University School of Public Health, and author of the forthcoming book, Exchange Politics, Opposing Obamacare in Battleground States. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you both for having me.
So help us set the stage a little bit. Give us sort of that 30,000-foot view of the evolution of the healthcare debate in the Trump years.
Sure.
Six months.
I mean, the first thing to say is the failure of passing Obamacare repeal is a debacle on par, if not exceeding, what happened with Clinton in 1993, 1994. I mean, they had 7 years opposing Obamacare to come in and have something prepared. They just couldn't get something passed.
So let's unpack that a little
bit.
Why? This is actually a criticism that President Trump himself has thrown at Senate Republicans.
Sure.
You had 7 years. You should have had a plan. Why didn't they have a plan?
Yeah, so the first reason, I think they really did not expect Donald Trump to win the presidency in November. They really just didn't. So they didn't feel like they had to have a plan because they thought they could just go along opposing Obamacare in Congress under President Hillary Clinton. So that's the first thing. They really just didn't feel they needed to have a plan. And there's a reality that once you give a benefit to people, right, you give health insurance through Medicaid, through the exchanges, it's really hard to take that away. The Affordable Care Act has not been particularly popular over the last 7 years. But ironically, the opposition, like trying to repeal Obamacare, is ignited support. So now people realize, oh, I have something, and I don't want it taken away. So it's changed public opinion, which I think has made it harder to repeal Obamacare.
So you said that the ACA was not particularly popular during the 7 years preceding President Trump. Why? I mean, why? And why did Republicans try so repeatedly and failing every time to repeal it during that 7 year period preceding?
I think there's a variety of reasons. One, it's really hard to message something as complicated as healthcare in general, let alone a reform that didn't have a clear message. It expands coverage through Medicaid, through the exchanges, through children being able to stay on their parents' plan up till 26. Just that simple explanation I tried to give already was too long for a soundbite. Whereas if you're opposing the Affordable Care Act, you can just say limits freedom, it taxes, right? And it's much easier to message against it. And there's a reality too that so much of the way the Affordable Care Act works happens at the state level. So, you know, you can't even craft a simple national message because it really depended on state level governors, legislators cooperating or not as well.
Why can't the American people come up with health policy and health plans that work? Other advanced developed nations have done that. We have struggled and failed since the days of Bill Clinton and before. Why? Why can't we? It's not like we don't have smart people in this country.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And there were moments historically where the US healthcare system was really similar to the way healthcare operates in Canada or Europe. And we just went in slightly different direction, or we didn't go in the direction as Canada or other countries went in their direction. And then just kind of the deeper you got into the healthcare system entrenched as it is, the harder it was to change it. And actually a really interesting turning point was in the 1970s under President Richard Nixon. He proposed a reform that was basically the Affordable Care Act and how it would expand coverage. Ted Kennedy and some of the liberals said, this isn't liberal enough. We can get a Canadian style reform, and so we're going to oppose this. and try, you know, when we win in the 1970, or I guess in subsequent elections, then we could enact the big liberal reform. That just didn't happen. Ted Kennedy went on to say that was one of his greatest regrets in terms of legislative politics.
So I think that, you know, so I hijacked your answer to the question about sort of setting the stage.
Sure.
But so let's for the sake of the rest of the conversation,
sure,
let's walk through a little bit. So, you know, so President Trump's inaugurated, the congressional Republicans say this is going to be our first priority.
Right.
There is a real struggle to get anything done in the House.
Yeah.
Take us from there.
Yeah, so there were, the debate happened really in two stages, in the House, as you mentioned, and then in the Senate. The expectation was reform. The ACA was dead. It's just a matter of how and when and how much. The real turning point, I think, was at the end of January in 2017. Republicans from the House, they had a little retreat where they got together outside of Philadelphia and they said, we're going to come out of this with a clear message, a clear plan. Someone snuck into that meeting pretending to be the spouse of a member of Congress and secretly recorded conversations. Maybe not the most ethical thing, but then they released that. And the private conversations were, we have no idea what we're doing. We own this thing now. This is a disaster. What are we going to do? And it became clear they didn't have a plan. So they tried to, you know, recover from that. And what you do when you don't have a plan, and you don't have a plan that you think is going to be that popular, is you do a lot of in secret. So Paul Ryan was working behind the scenes without releasing bills, without having a lot of hearings, without really even letting the Congressional Budget Office do analysis. So they rushed through this bill, had a big disaster at the end of March where President Trump said, if you don't vote for this bill, it's dead, but it still failed. Interestingly though, not because the bill was too harsh or would take away insurance from too many people, but because a lot of really conservative members of the House felt it didn't do enough to repeal Obamacare. So we had this moment where in the House it looked like it was dead, but then it revived kind of in a weird way that's hard to describe. They felt like they really, 7 years we've had, you know, these promises, we have to honor it. So they revived kind of out of the blue, passed something in the House with just a margin of 4 votes, and then turned it over to the Senate, where we watched more or less the same process play out. Secret meetings, no analysis by the Congressional Budget Office, rush votes that happened after midnight, that, I mean, really culminated in a dramatic moment where John McCain was the deciding vote. He put the thumbs down, and the health bill died in the Senate for now.
So I don't want to put too fine a point on this, but there's a member of the Senate from Pennsylvania, I want to say Toomey, basically admitted that we didn't think Donald Trump was going to win. We didn't need a plan because we didn't think that we were going to have the responsibility of governing.
Yeah.
Isn't this the height of cynicism?
Yeah, and to take it a step further, when some of these Senate Republicans were asked, okay, what's your goal? Now you're in charge, you have this majority, you have the White House, what's your goal with health reform? They would say, well, to repeal Obamacare. And the reporter said, okay, but what's your goal? Mm-hmm. Is it reduce costs, increase access? What's the policy goal? And the answer was, our goal is to get to 50. Our goal is to repeal Obamacare. And it became clear, I think, that this was political solutions for political problems, not really policy solutions for policy problems.
We're going to get to your book in about 15 seconds.
Okay.
During that 15 seconds, look into the crystal ball. What happens now?
Yeah, so I think if the Republicans are smart, they would let this go a little bit and move on. That I don't think they can win on this issue on health reform right now. And it's hijacked their agenda and everything else. But the way this went in the House is it seemed dead and suddenly revived. And so I think I'd be a fool to make a real clear prediction about the way this would play out.
A lot of people have looked bad making predictions
exactly.
In the last 9 months.
Well, we won't ask you to actually make one. So
yeah.
Talk about your book, which really is about the Affordable Care Act and how states implemented or did not implement via the health exchanges. And that's coming out when?
Yeah,
very
so
soon.
This fall, end of October.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the title again, it's Exchange Politics Opposing Obama Grant. Exchange Politics Opposing Obamacare in Battleground States.
Yeah, so the idea of this book is, as I mentioned earlier, the Affordable Care Act really gives a lot of flexibility to states. So there's no uniform way an exchange had to be done per se. And it actually, the interesting thing about the exchanges, and just for anyone who's watching who might not have a clear sense of what that is, it's a website sort of like a Priceline.com where someone could go on and they can compare health insurance plans. And they get a subsidy from the government that they can use to buy a health insurance and afford their premium. The idea for an exchange is a Republican idea. Mitt Romney included it in his reform in Massachusetts. The Heritage Foundation, when he did that, said it would be a model for the nation to follow. It was happening in Utah, it was happening in Mississippi. So the idea that Democrats and President Obama had is if we put an exchange in the Affordable Care Act, it'll be popular, right? Republicans might complain and try to oppose the passage of the law, but ultimately they'll support this. And so in the Affordable Care Act, they said, we'll give you all the money you want to do an exchange, like hundreds of millions of dollars flowing to the states to do an exchange. And if you don't do it, the federal government's gonna come in and take over for you. So that combination of carrots and sticks felt like states really should do this. In the end, though, surprisingly, only 14 states chose to do their own exchange. So the question in my book is why? Why did so few states take this up? And the answer, you know, there's many layers to it, but the short answer is that the simple explanation of partisanship is incomplete, right? So the simple explanation might be Republicans oppose Democrats, they didn't want to give Barack Obama a win, so they blocked it. And that's there's certainly an element to that. But what's interesting, I think, when I went, I did about 200 interviews for this process with state leaders. When you really look at this, the main division was not Republican versus Democrat. It was within the Republican Party. So all the dynamics that we've seen played out on the national stage this year within the Trump administration on health reform have been playing out at the state level over the last 7 years.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? So sure. What is the division within the Republican Party?
Yeah, so it's largely between this moderate group that, you know, opposes Democrats and wants to do things a conservative free market way, but is willing to talk and willing to work and, you know, sees the ACA as, to some extent, a free market approach. And then there's the Tea Party wing. Mm-hmm. So really, the charting the history of the exchanges at the state level is a charting of the growth of the Tea Party. The exchange became the issue that the Tea Party really focused on at the state level. And so using that to mobilize, get people to show up to things. And if I could say, my personal politics, you know, I don't really align with the Tea Party in a lot of ways. And some of these interviews were really frustrating because I felt like, you know, they were making jumps in logic that didn't make sense to me. But they were incredibly passionate and showed up, like they really inserted themselves into the government political process. They showed up to legislative hearings. They showed up whenever the governor was going to be somewhere. And it was really impressive, actually. I think if liberals wanted to take lessons on how to oppose the Trump administration, should really look to the Tea Party in the early Affordable Care Act years.
So another one of your big interests in your scholarship is health outcomes.
Yeah.
And this country spends as a percentage of its gross domestic production nearly more than any other developed country. And yet we have some of the lowest amongst that group outcomes in terms of infant mortality, in terms of life expectancy, and other markers. We spend all this money, what are we getting for it? And why is there that disparity between the money spent and the outcome?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's important, actually, that we're raising this question because I don't think enough people are asking this question. And it's the question that's motivating my current project that I'm working on, looking at health in the Mississippi Delta. Because exactly as you know, whether it's obesity, cardiac conditions, maternal mortality, I think is particularly interesting. The U.S., you know, rather than being the world leader, we're like 38th in the world in some of these categories. And so a question that keeps me up at night sometimes is, you know, what can we do about this? And Mississippi is particularly interesting to me because if you look at any of those outcomes that we talked about, Mississippi is the worst in the nation, right? There's a joke among health policy people who work at health policy at the state level that thank goodness for Mississippi or we'd be worse, right? Because there's always somebody worse than us. And then if you look at a map of Mississippi and the parts of the state, you look at outcomes by county, the Delta in the northwest part of the state are by far the worst part of the state, right? So the Delta is arguably the least healthy place in America. So my goal with my current project is to go to the Delta and really try to understand like what's happening there to lead to these really bad outcomes and what can we learn from there that we can take to the rest of the nation.
I'm going to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this program can be heard 3 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States, the POTUS Channel 124. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Selva Virginia University. You can follow me on Twitter, and I hope you will, @JMLutis. My co-host, an award-winning journalist from the Providence Journal, is G. Wayne Miller, and you can follow him on Twitter too, at G. Wayne Miller. Story in the Public Square is produced each week by a tremendous team of professionals at Rhode Island PBS in Providence, Rhode Island. Our guest this week is David Jones from Boston University School of Public Health and author of the forthcoming book, Exchange Politics, Opposing Obamacare in Battleground States. And his Twitter handle is Decline Jones, D-K-L-I-N-E-J-O-N-E-S, Decline Jones. So David, let me ask you, you were talking about health outcomes and why the United States lags. Let's turn the camera around a little bit, if we will. Okay. Why do countries like Japan and Sweden and Canada and Germany have better outcomes than the United States? What are they doing differently than what we're doing in the United States?
Yeah, so the answer is, I think, really complicated. And but I think the short answer is they're choosing to spend a balance of their money on social services rather than just healthcare, right? So if you look at how much the United States spends on healthcare versus things like education and housing and things like that, we maybe are 2-to-1 in terms of healthcare to social services.
It's like 16, 17, 18% of GDP on healthcare, right?
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Whereas if you look at a lot of those countries you just mentioned, they tend to spend, you know, a similar ratio but reverse, 2-to-1 the other way. They'll spend more money on housing and helping people with just basic needs. Recognizing that healthcare is an important part of someone's health, but if you really want to improve, if health is the policy goal that we have, then you focus on things in addition to healthcare.
This is a theme that comes up repeatedly on this show, sort of a common sense approach to life and to managing a society that other countries seem to have gotten right. And it comes up with incarceration, it comes up with health, it comes up with housing, education, all of these issues in the U.S. Why can't we, I mean, this is my frustration, why can't we, this great country, get it right? What's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it ties back to the conversation we had earlier, that ultimately it comes down to a question of what is the role of government in doing this, right? Because I think, you know, most Americans you talk to would agree that we hope people are healthy, we hope that they do well. But the real divide we have in this country is whether it's my job as a taxpayer to help make sure someone else is all right. And I think there's just a real fundamental split in this country on that question.
Well, you know, society has just become so complicated and interconnected and advanced that the old model isn't working. Hmm. Not for everyone, certainly. I mean, that's my view. I write about a lot of these issues in my own journalism. Anyway, that's my frustration. It never gets better the more we talk to people.
Yeah. Where do you see this debate moving? I mean, you said that, you know, and I'm not thinking about the next 6 months. I'm thinking about,
right,
you know, if I can be cynical for a second about politics, parties like hot button issues because it's a way to mobilize your base.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm sure 2020 Republicans will be talking about we need to, you know, put more loyal Republicans into the House and Senate who are gonna help us repeal Obamacare. And Democrats, I'm sure, are saying we need these wins, we need these seats to protect what we have and to improve and to you know, tweak. Politically, 2018, 2020, where do you think this goes?
Yeah, so I think where I would like to see it go is that there's a shift or reframing in the debate so that the goal isn't just win the House, win the Senate, or improving access to insurance or repealing Obamacare. But the real question is, how do we improve health, right? And make that the focus. I don't know that I expect that to happen. I have a lot of Democratic friends. A lot of the students that I teach are fairly liberal. And it was interesting this past semester to burst their bubble a little bit, because they expected, okay, you know, Donald Trump presidency is really not going well from their point of view. I'm sure people can see that. And Democrats are just going to go gangbusters in the House and the Senate in 2018 and 2020. If you look at the map, though, the Senate map is so unfavorable to Democrats in 2018. I think it's extremely unlikely that they win control there. And although I think the health reform debate has shifted the chance and maybe increased the chance the Democrats have in the House, probably the odds are they still don't have the numbers there. What that means for 2020, I think, is going to be, it's a fascinating question. But I think it's, that's the short-term question. The big long-term question should be how do we improve health?
Well, and to that end, I mean, even the way we're talking about it here is in really specifically partisan terms,
sure,
right? is there any prospect for bipartisan approach? I mean, so I spent enough time in D.C. to know that you pass a big piece of legislation like the Affordable Care Act, there needs to be, there's going to be a second pass at it where you tweak the dials and you zero in on right. mechanisms that actually work. We didn't do that with the Affordable Care Act because control of the House and Senate flipped. Is there any prospect of a bipartisan approach to health care that might actually last and not just, you know, careen from one side to the other depending on who's in power?
Right. Yeah, I think there's a chance. I mean, in the fallout of the Senate bill not passing recently, there's been some movement among some senators to try to have conversations across the aisle. There's been some conversations in the House. The place that I'm really looking that I think would be interesting is at the state level. Mm-hmm. What do governors do? What do state legislators do? And there's some really interesting research coming out of the Milbank Memorial Fund and the Commonwealth Fund right now, a survey asking the state legislators who serve on the key committees, you know, what are your priorities? And then taking that data and really trying to find what is the common ground and try to use that to help reframe what the debate should be on health reform.
Interesting.
So when you described the Mississippi Delta project right. to me briefly over the phone a few days ago, I grew increasingly excited. This is a great project.
Thank you.
And to me, it has some very interesting features in terms of research and methodology. And there's a tie-in also to Bobby Kennedy.
That's right.
Robert Kennedy. So tell us more about the project.
Yeah, so the question, as I said, was thinking about how do we shift the conversation in the United States about health reform? And I realized about a year and a half ago that early 1967 was the 50th anniversary of Robert Kennedy's trip to the Delta. Mm-hmm. He went there as a member of a subcommittee in the Senate in 1967. And so the question really stuck in my mind of going back there 50 years later, looking at are things better or not, what's changed? So that's the hook that I use to get people interested in the project.
Before you get into the project, yeah. what did he do exactly 50 years ago?
Yeah, so he really, as iconic as this trip was, and it's, you know, it's been written about quite a bit, and there's movies documenting it, he was really only there for about a day and a half. And he went to the towns of Greenville and Cleveland and Clarksdale and a couple other little small towns, and he just met people. He walked into people's shacks and talked to them. There's some really poignant stories of him, you know, talking to a child with a distended belly who just is staring off into space, not answering any questions. And he came home from that trip saying he just didn't know that kind of poverty was possible in
because
America.
Because he was Northeast, you know, Kennedy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
He must have had the reaction, this is America.
Yeah, no, and he said he had seen this in Africa before when he visited there.
Wow.
But he had never seen this in America.
So you're down there and you're following sort of in his footsteps.
A little bit, yeah, and not too literally. I mean, there's a wonderful journalist at University of Mississippi who is literally tracking down the people he spoke to, and I'm really excited about her book coming out. My question is more to take a snapshot now 50 years later, look at these cities he visited and ask how are people doing? And as I sort of answered already, the Delta is currently the least healthy place in America. So it's a sad story in some ways, but.
One of your research tools is something that I was not familiar okay. with, but it's called Photo Voice.
Yeah.
It intrigues me from a storytelling perspective okay. and from a research perspective. Tell our audience what Photo Voice is and how you use it and what you can expect to learn from it.
Yeah, so one of the challenges that I face as sort of like what Bobby Kennedy faced, going down as a northerner from an elite university, as a white man, is, you know, the danger that I'm just going to impose my northern story on what's happening in the Delta. And I really want to be respectful of that and talk to leaders down there who say we don't want just the bad stories coming out, we want all the stories of good things that are happening here. So what I've done is, with a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, I'm convening focus groups of people that live in the area, and we're giving them cameras, and we're asking them questions like, "What, you know, tell us about your neighborhood. Is it safe? Where do you buy groceries? Is your housing safe and affordable?" And then we ask them, go out and take pictures of your environment. Come back a week later, and we're going to use those pictures as the basis for a conversation. With the hope being that the insights that we get from that will be so much more rich than just me walking through the grocery store or just asking someone to tell me about their life. We're early in that process, so I don't have, it's not clear exactly what it'll yield yet, but I was just there last week meeting the focus groups for the first time, and it was incredibly inspiring and exciting to see these, in one case, a group of teenagers that are participating in this, and then another group of people in the community of Cleveland. And it's clear the stories are just going to be incredible. Already, they're telling stories just on healthcare, for example. One person told me that the chaos around the Affordable Care Act right now scared her so much that she is forgoing insurance just because, like, she's afraid that Trump would take it away. So she's made the decision to forego herself. Anyway, stories like that.
It sounds like you're being well received. You're being welcomed into these communities.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was a little bit nervous about it, to be honest, that I would go down there and there would be some apprehension. The Delta is an area that is...
Because you're a stranger from
from
Northeast.
Boston, that's right. The Delta is overstudied in some ways. There's a lot of outsiders, Habitat for Humanity, church groups, from people from other universities around Boston. And so there's some apprehension, but I'm finding people really love this angle or this dynamic where it's not just me trying to tell their stories, but I'm asking them to tell their own stories.
Well, you're empowering them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
in
that's how I see
storytelling.
It. I'm pleased that's how they see it, too.
You suggested something there, and I wonder if there's, beyond sort of, are there other examples of stories that you're hearing where people responding to this national tumult around healthcare are making really serious decisions about their own healthcare because of the uncertainty? Is that more than just a single anecdote, or have you heard more stories like that?
Yeah, so two thoughts. One is I've been asking people whether the tumult around the Affordable Care Act is making them more cynical or less cynical, more likely to engage in politics or less. And pretty universally, I'm hearing people are more cynical and are not tuning away. Like, they're feeling like, I need to step up and do something, which has been real interesting.
Well, that's a positive.
Yeah.
They want to become involved.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing, one of the interviews that's been most fascinating to me is I was interviewing a Trump voter who works in healthcare, who is just, hates Obamacare, doesn't like what Republicans are doing to the Affordable Care Act either, and strongly prefers that we had a single-payer healthcare system, which kind of blew my mind, talking to a Trump voter wanting single-payer. And so I don't know if there's something there, but there's actually some polls that show that Trump voters are different than traditional Republicans in that way.
We're going to have to leave it there. David Jones, the book is Exchange Politics, Opposing Obamacare in Battleground States. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. That's
all the time we have this week, but we want to thank everyone at home for joining us, too. If you want to learn more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis. We hope you'll join us again next week for more Story in the Public Square.